This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello and welcome to Mountain News and World Report. I'm your host, Marley Green. In this episode, we remember tragic news from our region's past, and we explore current news about public health crises in our mountains and of new economic development projects. February 26 marks the 46th anniversary of the Buffalo Creek disaster in Logan County, West Virginia. We begin our program with a piece from the WMMT archives produced by Mimi Pickering.
At 8 a.m. February 26, 1972, a coal waste dam collapsed at the head of a holler in Logan County, West Virginia. Over 132 million gallons of water and 1 million tons of sludge barreled through the 16 coal mining communities along Buffalo Creek. 125 people were killed. 4,000 were left homeless. Shirley Markham from Lundale was one of the survivors.
Well, 8:30 sharp, my house lifted up off the foundation and floated into the neighbor's house. The house on the upper side of mine come in, floated in against my house, knocked my house off of its foundation. They both went into my neighbor's house, and the water, I could not see over the top of that when it first come in sight. The only warning we had was just a neighbor woman had spotted it and just pulled in front of our house and hollered, "Run, the dam has broke." And then you could hear the roar of it, and you could see it. I saw my neighbor's houses leave. I watched them crumble. I seen trees, logs, cars, slate, slush. You name it, and it was in that. After we got through to safety and all and turned around, I saw five houses floating down the creek, and you could walk on from one to the other. One house particularly, I don't know who they were. At the time I didn't know who they were, but I found out later they was the Ballard and Janice Luke Carter family. It was five of them in the house.
We never got out.
No, they're all gone.
An official of the Pittston Company, owners of the dam, stated, "We're investigating the damage which was caused by the flood, which we believe, of course, was an act of God. The dam was simply, quote, incapable of holding the water God poured into it." Survivor Ronnie Smith was interviewed at the Red Cross shelter at the Mann High School.
My neighbors come and woke me and my wife up on Saturday morning. I'd got up to fix fires up and watching television with the kids, and the power went off. And they come knocking on the door and hollering and said, "The dam broke up." Well, we'd been expecting maybe to hear this word, because we'd stayed up till 2 o'clock at night watching for the flood, because the waters was high and was afraid we might get washed out then. But it still hadn't dawned on us until we looked around and we'd seen our neighbors running around like crazy trying to warn everybody that the dam had broke. Well, we got ready and I run out on the creek bank with a bunch more of the men there. There's about five of us. We'd heard that there was a woman and a baby floating down the creek on part of a house. Well, we stayed out there until there was no longer any need for a stand there, because the creek was getting up high, and they all took off and left me there by myself there. My wife had got the kids in the car and started up and was waiting on me. And just as I happened to look up out of the side of my eye, I saw it coming. And I took off running for the car, and I warned the people down the creek as I went that the water was coming. They wouldn't believe me, and I told them, I said, "Well, look out there. You can see the house coming down the creek." But still, they didn't believe. If just a few took off. Well, we went on down the road then, warning more as we come along to them. And we got our kids to safety, and then we took off back to where we could see what was happening as damage was coming down the creek. We've seen about 14 houses destroyed as they hit the bridge. And about 5 cars, and there was many lives lost. But this is the most tragic thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm sorry that God let me live to see it.
In Logan County, where coal is the king, where the people work hard for most everything, on Buffalo Creek it was cloudy and gray, and the people were rising to meet a new day. The bacon was sizzling and the coffee was poured, but the dam up the holler couldn't hold any more. And the water raged down, smashed town after town. Homes dashed to pieces and whole families was drowned. How could it happen, said, how could it be? That dam, it belonged to the coal company. An act of God, the bosses did cry. But God ain't that cruel, we can see through your lie. Who ordered the dozer to build that dam? And who's living high off the work of our hands? Who takes our coal but don't share in the fear? Yes, whose greed for money has cost us so dear? Yes, whose greed for money has cost us so dear?
Tom Bethel was research director at the United Mine Workers in 1975.
There were various estimates of what it would have cost to build a dam properly, ranging from about $50,000 to about $200,000. Whichever figure you choose, it's obviously not very much. And the question that comes up about why Pittston didn't do it probably is a very large question in terms of why the coal industry has never done anything more than it has absolutely had to do. In the area that it works in, you know, why do people strip mountains in Appalachia and not put it back? Aside from the fact that you can't put it back from gravity, but I mean, why don't they even make the effort? Why do people not make the effort to clean up their mines until you have a Farmington disaster that causes such a storm of outrage that you get a federal law passed finally and they have to do something? Why don't they do it? Well, they don't do it because this industry has a long tradition of getting by on the cheap. You just keep on producing coal until something goes wrong, and you hope you're going to get by. And you sit up there in New York, and you look at the figures, and you forget all about the people living down there. Kamisha probably never knew that dam existed, probably never had any idea that it existed, and if told about it, probably would have put it in his basket, you know, to be dealt with at some point, and, you know, but it wasn't relevant. It just wasn't relevant.
I didn't see God driving them slate trucks up there and wearing a hard hull cap. I did not see that at no time when I visited the dam. That's the way I feel about it. I don't believe it was an act of God. It was an act of man.
Next, we bring you two pieces from the Ohio Valley Resource. The first focuses on the unprecedented black lung epidemic in central Appalachia today. The second brings us information about a new data analysis system being used to address the opioid epidemic in West Virginia.
The central Appalachian coal fields are in the middle of an unprecedented epidemic of severe black lung disease. A recent medical study confirmed a cluster of more than 400 cases of the most severe form of black lung at just a few clinics. and an investigation by NPR and the Ohio Valley Resource identified nearly 2,000 cases across Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. The condition caused by coal mine dust is often debilitating and deadly. Reporter Benny Becker brings us the stories of two men struggling with the disease.
Black lung disease is often considered incurable, and the two men you're about to hear from are grappling with that reality. One is struggling to stay alive, weighed down by the condition's steep financial and emotional costs. The other has made a remarkable recovery, thanks to some very expensive treatments.
I'm Jerry Hilton, 64 years old, live in Buchanan County, Virginia. I run every piece of equipment underground, and I was section foreman longer than I were run equipment or anything like that. When I was section foreman, it's always in the face, production crew. You're constantly in and out of the dust if you check on your people like you're supposed to. And I always try to make sure I checked on my people. We always had good ventilation, but whatever went through my nose and mouth, it stuck to me. Labor Day weekend in 2010, that's when I noticed my breathing was just a little bit different. Then about a couple weeks later, I couldn't hardly breathe, you know. The doctor says my lungs started shutting down. They said it's hardened just like a lump of coal. And the doctors pulled me out of the work, and he recommended me to see if I could have a lung transplant. They evaluate you where the doctors, they sort of laughed and joked, and they said if they wanted to check me out and see if I was worthy enough to spend $3 million on. In 2016, they gave me about 6 months to live if I didn't get a set of lungs. So I got the lung transplant. July the 18th, 2016. The surgery took longer than they participated. I went into a coma. My kidneys shut down, my liver shut down, everything in my body shut down, and they kept me on 21 different machines for 3 weeks, what time I was in that coma. My understanding, there were several times they thought I wasn't going to make it. I don't remember nothing for that 3 weeks. I remember them put me on the operating table, and then when I woke up 3 weeks later, and when I realized I couldn't move, it scared me. I couldn't move nothing unless somebody else moved me. I didn't have no control of my head or nothing, no muscles at all. You know, my head would just flop. When I left in November, I had all I could take. I was getting down in the dumps. And I said, Dr. Boz, you better be getting your crap together. I'm going home Friday if I have to crawl out of here. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die at house. He agreed to let me come home, but he made me promise him I'd be back in 2 weeks. My doctor tells me he had never had a patient leave the hospital in the shape that I left it in and walk back in that hospital like I did in July. After my transplant, I was in a wheelchair, and now I'm walking on my own. My balance is almost back to 100%, and my breathing is wonderful. It's great. I can breathe.
Retired miner Jerry Hilton talking about his long road to recovery from black lung disease. Before he left, I had one more question for him.
You mind if I just record the sound of you walking? It's kind of a, no. Since it is a little bit of a miracle.
I wear boots all my life. When I left the hospital, I couldn't get my boots on. I wore tennis shoes, and I hated them. I'm a boot man.
For Jerry Hilton, the system is working. He has a new set of lungs, and he's continuing down the path to recovery one step at a time. Many others who struggle with the disease don't have access to those treatments. Edward Brown is a 55-year-old disabled miner from Buchanan County, Virginia, which borders both Kentucky and West Virginia. His black lung diagnosis has been certified by federal researchers, but he was turned down for state benefits. Brown says hardship is what brought him into the mines, and it's followed him ever since.
I had to support my family, and I couldn't find a decent enough job outside the mines around this area to make a living, so I went. And I hated it. Every day you was worried when that rock's going to fall on you and kill you. They're all dusty, I'm telling you. You eat a lot of dust. It's first of the 90s. Come out of them dust masks, and when you'd sweat, them little old filters, they would clog up, and then it felt like somebody just sitting there with their hand over your face. So tried to wear it all the time, but you couldn't. I got mashed in the mines a couple of times with big rocks, and it messed my back up. 2003, they laid us all off. So I started going to the doctor, and then he just said, you don't need to go back in the mines, not with two hips that needed to be replaced. And then it was one medical bill after another. So I had to sell my trailer, had to sell my truck, waited 6.5 years before I got my disabled Social Security. I'm on it. That's it. Somebody said, you need to go file for your rock dust. Silicosis, I think, is rock dust. And my doctor said I had it, but he just give you the runaround, man. They said I didn't have it. My family doctor kept saying, your lungs is in bad shape. File for your black lung. I said, I didn't know you could if you ain't got rock dust. I went up there to that one doctor, and he started putting me on oxygen and all this medicine. And I said, man, I ain't got the money to pay for all this. I can't afford it. What do you do?
Is there anything you're kind of hoping for the future?
Yeah, I'd like to get better, but it's all I got to look forward to get worse and worse, you know. I'm just hard to breathe and hard to do anything anymore, you know. You can't do nothing, man. Sit at the daggone house and worry about how you're going to pay the next bill, you know. And just like I've heard a lot of these guys, you know, want to commit suicide because they're letting their family down, you know. It really sucks, man, and it weighs on a lot of people's minds, you know. And it was weighed on mine for so long. I'm an alcoholic now. I get some of this stuff on my mind and can't get it off of my mind unless I drink, you know. The doctor down there is trying to help me, but I don't know. Nobody looks forward to dying, you know, but it's a coming.
I spoke with Edward Brown last month at a black lung clinic in Grundy, Virginia. He's still waiting to hear if he'll be awarded federal black lung benefits. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker.
The story was produced in partnership with an NPR investigation. And because the story mentions suicide, we want you to know that if you or someone you know is thinking about suicide or would like emotional support, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The numbers on the Ohio Valley's opioid crisis are grim, especially so in West Virginia, which has the nation's highest rate of overdose deaths. But a deep dive into those numbers might help to bring down the death toll. Aaron Payne sat down with the state's chief health officer to learn how a new data analysis shows opportunities to keep people alive.
Imagine having the ability to identify people at risk of drug overdose and then reach them before they die. This was the hope of researchers from the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources when they built a profile from more than 800 fatal overdoses in 2016. Dr. Rahul Gupta is one of the leaders in the state facing the worst of the addiction crisis as commissioner of the DAHR's Bureau for Public Health and state health officer. He says information they gathered helped them identify risk factors and could reach others before it's too late.
Rather than just continue to count numbers, let's start to understand those individuals and their lives as human beings and understand what can we learn from those human beings and what were the specific factors that made them more susceptible to fatal overdoses.
What were some of the factors or categories that you were most interested in looking at?
Did they actually have insurance? What type of insurance? What were their earlier life experiences? Did they call 911? Did EMS respond? Were they given naloxone? Was it appropriately recognized that these people were having an overdose?
And within the results, what was one thing that maybe you found that you did not expect to find?
9 out of 10 of all the decedents had a documented history within the controlled substance monitoring program. That means they received a prescription. In the 30 days prior to their death, nearly half of the women decedents filled a controlled substance prescription, and 36% of the men did the same.
People who died were almost 3 times more likely to have 3 or more prescribers compared to everyone listed in the prescription drug monitoring program. The report also found that opioids were among the 2 most common controlled substance prescriptions filled 12 months prior to death. It also estimates 35 to 54-year-old unmarried males with a high school education or less working a blue-collar occupation as potentially at the highest risk of an overdose. When Gupta looks at those patterns in the numbers, he sees places where an intervention might help, whether it's through the prescribing system, law enforcement, or emergency services. About 70% had used emergency services in the year before their death.
We found that when people called for help, only 31% of decedents had naloxone administration documented. The critical piece to address the problem immediately is to help people at the time of overdose. It's critical to understand that overdose deaths are pretty much preventable. This report helps us take actions and steps necessary to prevent those deaths, but also understand that only can people enter into treatment when we can prevent them from dying.
While the data focuses on West Virginia, are there any lessons within the report that you think could apply to neighboring states?
I certainly think so. I think the work that was done for the fatality report, I think you're going to find very similar reasons and findings in our neighboring states because as a region, we struggle with same challenges. There's a lot of similarities. While we're divided by boundary lines, we're the same people. We need to learn this particular disorder as a chronic disease, as risk factors. This is one way that we can actually really understand what their lives were about, what were the risks that they suffered that went unrecognized, and use that data to prevent future deaths from happening.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Aaron Payne.
Last in this edition of Mountain News and World Report, Rich Kirby brings us the story of a new restaurant and hotel in St. Paul, Virginia, which aims to increase economic development through tourism in the region.
When we came here first, I was saying, why are we in this part of the country? What are we doing? And so when we met with everybody the very first time, and I thought I was coming to look at a building, and I walked into the town hall, and there were 40 people there that had prepared breakfast and were waiting for a presentation that I wasn't ready to present, I realized the passion of this community.
That was Kimberly Christner of a company called Creative Boutique Hotels. She was speaking at the opening of a new hotel in a sort of unlikely spot, the middle of a small coalfield town in southwest Virginia.
We go where other developers wouldn't dare go. This rural community where risk is a big factor. We come here. We enjoy being a part of a community. And while we may be the developers and the creative partners, we firmly believe and see this as a community project. We want you to be proud of what we've done. We want you to support it. And we want this development to be a catalyst for transformation and growth.
That goal was central to the many community members who worked to bring the new hotel to town. Lou Ann Wallace is the founder of the nonprofit group St. Paul Tomorrow.
The bigger picture here is economic revitalization in the coal fields of southwest Virginia. And what we did in 2000, we were all thinking the same thing. And when we all found each other and came together, we sat down and did a strategic plan. We chose what's happening here today. And we're not just about Southwest Virginia, we're talking about a tri-state region because we're all in the Appalachian region together. And this is a great opportunity for us all to talk about how to model and remodel our coal fields.
One of the things about tourism is a lot of people think it's marketing, and it is.
The new hotel is part of an effort to revive St. Paul through tourism. The town has already welcomed an ATV business, a river outfitter, and a brewery. And people hope the state will someday establish a Clinch River State Park. Many mountain communities are looking to tourism to improve their fortunes. Wirt Conroy of the Virginia Tourism Corporation told the crowd that such an effort involves a community looking inward at itself.
Tourism really is about planning and looking at your community and what you want it to be and making that happen and developing it and creating it. And then marketing, which marketing is just a fancy word for telling stories. You all have on purpose every day woken up, talked to yourselves, and made this happen. You really did. And that's what tourism is all about. So congratulations to you all for all of this. And the thing I'm most excited about is when I come back, I get to stay at the Western Front. So thank you so much.
The new enterprise is called the Western Front Hotel. Like the location, the name is unusual. It's rooted in St. Paul's past as a rowdy coalfield town. Longtime resident Marty Salyer explains.
There was several beer joints along the Western Front. So that's when you wanted to go and have a few beers. I think a lot of people from the area came to St. Paul. Again, that was long before my time. But I heard it was kind of rowdy from time to time, a little bit of party area, but all in the good sense. And we want to try to have it the same way in a good sense of the word, where this is a place that people can come, have a good camaraderie, find entertainment, be a part of the community, and enjoy themselves. Kind of after a long day's work, come to the St. Paul Western Front Hotel and relax. That's what we want. Yeah.
So it's not going to be just for people from out of town?
Oh, absolutely not. Please, it's going to be a part of the community. This is a community event. They have invested so much in this. The community has supported it from day one, and we'd really wondered if it could ever be done. So absolutely, this is the community's home. Absolutely, yeah.
Like any destination hotel, the Western Front has a restaurant. To run it, the developers brought in a nationally known chef who is also a local boy. Travis Milton grew up in the area and told the crowd at the opening about deciding to come home.
About 10 years ago, I was standing in a Michelin-starred restaurant in the middle of East Manhattan, and I was doing some of what they call molecular gastronomy, where you use all these crazy chemicals to do different things with food and get different textures and flavors. And I was there because I thought it was what I needed to be doing. It was what was hip in the culinary world and what was hip with food. And I had this moment where everything just kind of clicked in my head that this wasn't exactly what I wanted to be cooking or doing. And at that moment, I turned around and I looked to the chef and I said, I would much rather be cooking greasy beans than this. And he looked at me very bizarrely and said, why in the hell would you want a bean covered in grease? And then I knew, I was like, okay, he does not get it. And it was kind of a crystallizing moment in my mind and in my heart that I realized that I wanted to, what was true to me was cooking the food that I grew up with. That was the stuff that I wanted and that I craved. And when I decided that I wanted to do an Appalachian-themed restaurant, I knew that I had to do it here, because if I didn't do it here, I would be a part of the problem that I've always talked about.
One of the people attending the opening was Anthony Flacavento, who has worked for years helping communities in the region with economic development. He thinks St. Paul is a success story that other places might repeat.
Oh, I think it's phenomenal. I mean, both how they did it, which is with, I was just talking to the construction supervisor. He said they trained local people, many of whom had no building skills, to actually do the work, everything from the rough carpentry to the finishing work. Now some of those guys are working on the project in Bristol, so they use local labor. You can see all over local and recycled materials, local artisans to design. I mean, this is an example of what's possible when you decide we're going to build on what we've got right here. Just astonishing. So, and on top of that, with everything else St. Paul is doing, from the brewery to the trails system, et cetera, I think it's just going to, St. Paul's going to be like a model for what's possible for reinventing our economy locally.
What's it going to take for other communities to have something like this going on?
You know, hopefully, because of everything that happened here, it won't take as long as it took to kind of build the critical mass, if you want to call it that. But it's still going to take the same sort of, you know, Terry Venzel, Lou Wallace type people that are totally dedicated, that just won't quit, that won't say no. That's part of it. And then it takes people in leadership who have the purse strings saying, this is where we ought to be investing, not bringing big boxes to the outskirts of town.
Anthony Flacavento. The Western Front Hotel is now open for business, and people in St. Paul are hopeful there will be a lot of it. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Rich Kirby.
A town of 1,000 people, we've done pretty good. You know? Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News and World Report. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes again, visit our website at www.wmmt.org or download Mountain News wherever you get your podcasts. Music on this episode comes from the June Apple recording of Carla Gover with a tune called Sweet Fern. I've been your host, Marley Green, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.